This is Ken Paulson, interviewed via Skype by Chris Alden Lee on the 2nd of August 2013. Ken Paulson, Part 1.
Kenneth Paulson, Pawson, 7th of May 1923, in a little place called Triangle, near Halifax, in Yorkshire.
So how old are you now, Ken?
90.
Okay. Would you say your father was an educated man?
It depends what you mean. He was a farmer and a butcher. He was a damn good horseman. He was good with cattle. He was good with meat. He was good with me.
Did he read much?
Yes, he read lots of things. Well, many of these Western magazines and all things. His dad was out in Canada, you see, so he had a lot of interest in Canada because granddad ran cattle over here. And he was always a pile of Western magazines and anything. And he read anything, interesting things about the world. But as far as classical reading, well, he read the usual things every kid at school reads, you know what I mean? It's hard to answer that question because I always saw him with a book in his hand, but it was generally a paperback of some kind, you know what I mean?
Tell me about your education. What sort of education did you have, Ken?
I went to Triangle Elementary School. My mother was a school teacher, but not at that school. She was, in fact, she wasn't teaching when I was born. So I went to Triangle Elementary School. Which was a damn good little school, a matter of interest. When I got to Antarctica and eventually, and my friend Jeffrey Hatteras Smith, who just died just recently, we found that we had much of the same poetry, etc., and classical verses that we liked, because we happened to have the headmaster at Triangle School. He was a damn good scholar himself, and he was always reading poetry and etc. to us. So I felt very much in touch with DJF, and we often joked about this, that a guy from Little Triangle School and Winchester had much of the same classical interests.
Tell me a bit about Jeffrey, because I met him a few months ago, just before he died. What do you remember about him?
Oh, excellent guy. Couldn't have won better. Excellent man. He was a good sense of humour and a great leader, and he had enough courage to say what he thought about things, you know what I mean? And he was damn good. Mm. One of the best. And we spent many hours together on the rope, and that means something.
What made you want to think about going to the Antarctic, Ken?
Your Yorkshire Moors couldn't be better training than but, you know, we lived on near the Yorkshire Moors, and I was always used to wild, lonely places. And I'd read all the books that a kid always reads about the Scott Shackleton and the rest, you know what I mean? And, well, just lonely places that interested me. And I was also, for some reason, interested in... I was always interested in mapping for some reason. I know whenever my granny, my mother's mother, looked after me, because never going to church in the evening or something like that, I was always drawing maps on our own local area, you know, on Granny's house, and maps fascinated me, and marking where I was and where I'd been and things like that, and reading about the maps of the explorers and how they fixed their position and everything else. So, just one of those things that took over.
So, would you have joined the Ordnance Survey anyway?
Quite probably. I wanted to get in trained as a surveyor, if possible, you see. And towards the end of the war, it wasn't limited to what you could do and what you couldn't do. And I was fortunate enough to get into the Ordnance Survey and then take basic training there. Yeah.
How did the opportunity to come to the Antarctic arise?
Oh well, I. For several years, I decided I was going to go down there, And this is while I was still doing Air Force training in Canada and everything. And I wrote to all the, I just, when the war was drawing to a close, there was all sorts of things in the papers about Antarctic exploration starting again. So I wrote to every damn thing I could think of. I wrote to England, to South Africa, to Australia, to America, to anybody that might be sending somebody down the Antarctic. And England was the last to reply, of course. I then all got replies from South Africa and God knows where. And they were all at that stage, either not quite ready or going to take their own people or whatever. America, for instance, thanked me for my reply, my letter, but they were just taking the American force at that time. Then it was signed by, I noticed, Admiral Byrd. So I almost felt like signing the damn letter for an autograph. But it was anyway. That's how I got it. Actually, I tried everybody, eventually, when I was on my way back to England from Trinidad, a few years down there, there was a letter waiting at OHMS, you know, from British government, and it said that there was a vacancy that year for someone going to the Antarctic. You know, for me, wasn't it? Well, that was, but I had to be in time to catch the ship from Montevideo. Anyway, the damn ship had gone all but a week before or something like that. You know, it's a typical British mix-up. And I wrote back straight away, I think even before I got my bags unpacked and explained to them that sent it too damn late and that would be interesting going, what about next year? So they said, oh yeah, well, I had to wait until summer came or something, whatever. So that's how I got going.
Okay, so you had several months before departure.
Yeah.
What did you do? Did you have any special training in that period?
Oh yeah, I got in with the, I reconnected with the Ordnance Survey, I think, yeah. And this is a bit mixed up. I don't think I thought they were going to give me a course on more topographic surveys, more advanced stuff. And when I got down to somewhere near London where this course was supposed to be, I suddenly realized it was a repeat of the course I'd already done past. So I decided to go climbing with my friend instead in the Alps. And I thought, well, I can do this. I'm trying to get them more things. So eventually, somehow or other, I got through. I got told of the governor in the Falkland Islands, Miles Clifford, was in England at the time in hospital. Anyway, he recommended me for a course, or somehow he was part of it. Got recommended for a proper survey course, what I wanted, in University College London, and I sort of applied for this, signed up for this, I was going to be starting it a few weeks late, but they would take me on for it.
How did you meet Miles Clifford then? That's an unusual occurrence.
How did I meet me too?
Yeah. That's
who?
A lucky break. Miles Clifford, when you met Miles Clifford.
Oh, Miles Clifford. Oh, yeah. Well, I seem to think I knew him beforehand somehow, but I may be wrong there, but let's see. No, I'm not quite sure on that one.
Okay, don't worry.
But no, I'm rather interested now myself. Anyway, I met him, and he. I know. I think Miles Clifford came into it. Was after I'd already got down to. Yes, I think by that time I'd been down to Antarctica on that first year. Yeah, I think that was all part of it. I because I couldn't go when I just got back from England from the Air Force. I did get on for the following summer, and I remember seeing what the devil's his name, the Bingham.
Ted Bingham.
Yeah, Bingham.
He interviewed you, is that right?
Yeah. So I already gone through the mill with the basic interviews, etc. And at first, I remember I think it's in that little book of mine too. At first, if let's see, I wanted to get. Yeah, they went through that and decided that. I didn't seem hopeful at first, and then I said, "Well, they said, what other interests? I thought if you'd read the bloody letter, you'd see. Because I put in I reminded him I was a meteorologist. Oh, he said, that's just what we're wanting. You know, typical old UK colonial service. They screwed up like hell sometimes. They do a good job actually, but they are screwed up like hell sometimes. And they said, oh sure, that's just what you're wanting. You'll be on the short list. So from a few moments after being put on, then it was possible I was on the bloody short list. So. And in the meantime, I was out climbing in Europe with my friend, a friend who spent that part of the first year with me, Bill Bailey.
So that was Roy Bailey you were climbing with.
I beg your pardon?
It was Roy Bailey that you were climbing with.
Yeah, Bill. Everybody would call him Bill Roy.
Yeah.
Roy was his official name, you know, with tax purposes. But Bill, he's always Bill Bailey. Yeah, he's a great guy.
Okay. Were you expecting to be paid to go to the Antarctic?
No. I was going to pay them, but take me on an expedition if possible. You know, a reasonable set of sum. And when I realised I was getting a bloody salary, I thought it was better than that. Everything was different in those days. Yeah.
This was the first voyage south of the new John Biscoe, wasn't it?
It was, yeah.
Were you at the naming ceremony? Do you remember that?
I was, yes. And Mrs. Not Miles Swift, but Mrs. The secretary, secretary's wife, crashed a bottle of champagne against the thing and said, you know, did the ring? I was there. And we went out had a beer in a coffee shop nearby, and the Yorkshire papers made sure they had. The four of us Yorkshiremen on board was me, myself, of course, and good luck. I'm trying to get names now. Michael Green, who died in that fire at Hope Bay. He turned out to be one of the top surveyors going in the end, and one of the colleges in South Bristol. I think it was his name. It was an interesting thing about him. He was blown out of an exploding bomber, I remember. During the war, one of his stories, and he was a good skier. We went climbing together in Tierra del Fuego on our way back from Antarctica and horse riding together and racing. Good Lord. Anyway, we're coming.
What was the Biscoe like?
What was it like?
Hmm.
Well, I'm just wondering, are you asking me now as somebody who went on it and just as a trip didn't know that thing about those sort of things?
As a passenger, was it rough?
I remember, no, not really. I've been on rougher things in the Pacific, in the Caribbean, but in fact, I went through a hurricane in the Caribbean and lost half the bloody ship. It wasn't in that sense, no. But it was rough going. I mean, you didn't have anything fancy about it, but it was good food it was okay. But, you know, we were just after the war day, so anything was okay. We had I remember my friend, an old RAF friend who lived down in London. In fact, I stayed at his house when I was down there. He came in. I showed him a ship, and he came in and looked in one bunk and the other. So I said, "I suppose you'll get used to sleeping with the other guy a foot above your face, Ken." So it was pretty cramped quarters, but it was okay. We had a good time.
You were sharing a cabin with Dick Laws.
Pleasant guy, a good guy, knew what he was doing. He could ski too, which is something. You know, it's amazing that the very few people that went to Antarctica knew a damn thing about cold weather, climbing, tying right knots or anything. I think it was disgusting in a way that they should. The British government made a lot of screw-ups. Forget to say, they had to send all the vital things, and they didn't send cold weather equipment to the small bases because they're only four-man bases, they're not sledging bases. That's just bloody stupid. You want cold weather equipment at every damn base because it's, you know, it's like fire extinguishers in a house. You need the equipment to survive, and they didn't bloody well send it half the time. In the first year, until they realised what a screw up we were making, but and they assumed that it was tougher at a big base, 8 to 12 people, than it was at a small base. It's just the other bloody way around. You put new people in a group of four, and they've never been down there before or anything like that. That's a damn sight more testing for your ability to survive and to look after yourself than if you've got a group of 12, where there's a much different social structure altogether. The first year, the people who organised things in England, I've got no respect whatsoever for the people who did that kind of organising. They were a bloody screw-up, but they were everybody was a good man. I didn't meet anybody down there who wasn't, but you can't just put a bunch of greenhorns down the Antarctic and pluck one out because of some knowledge and put him as a base leader when he doesn't know a bloody thing about tying knots, you know. So it was just bad.
Would you say this was because the whole business of taking people to the Antarctic was such a newer concept, new idea?
Oh yeah, it probably was. It probably was. I mean, it was a new thing completely. Then what I'm saying is that I remember one of the Jeff Addison Smith saying he thought it was not long before he died, they said, you know, can I look back? I think it's almost criminal negligence the way they did some of those things.
How did he get around some of the problems? Did he make your own equipment?
I beg your pardon?
Did you find yourself having to make your own equipment?
Oh, my God, yes. If we did, we wouldn't have done anything. Jack Reed and Tim Nicol at Base F, they had to make all their own sleeping bags from sheets and blankets and pieces of canvas stitched together. And they had the minus 52 degrees temperature, the coldest weather the coast had ever seen that year. They had to make their own damn sleeping bags. I had to scrounge what I could from the American garbage dump. And I got a big two-man sleeping bag, which John Johnny Blythe and Bill Richards shared. I got a smaller one, which I had myself. I got some skis down there. I got, oh, God knows, if we hadn't gone through the American base and rifled it, it was really awful in throwaways. Mm. We wouldn't have done the damn thing. I got my tent, two tents from there. It was just ridiculous. You couldn't look in a... Well, here are the tents for this base. They never sent the damn things down, you know, unless you were a sledging base. And a four-man base wasn't supposed to be a sledging base, and yet that's not the point. You've got to be able to survive. One of the first most important things I did at our base when we got there was to divide all the equipment into three things. One, you know, the main dump in Nissen Hut, and then another dump. It's a triangle some distance away, and another dump. We had three dumps, so whichever way the wind came and on was blowing. I mean, you might lose two of your dumps, but you never lose all three at the same time. And, you know, that was... It was neat fun, though, in those days.
The American base you were scavenging from, that was Finn Ronnie's base, was it?
Finn Ronnie's base, yeah.
Did you ever meet them?
I did, yeah.
Tell me about that meeting.
Oh, I met him because he was his ship was in, well, it was Port of Bowman or something again. His ship was in the Margaret Bay, and we went down the first year on our way south, and we had to go to Margaret Bay to drop our guys off, you know, Fuchs and Crowd, and they, and he, Ben Ryan's ship was there on the two icebreakers, East Wind and something else. Anyway, they took us through the ice and went in. I met Ronnie, and yeah, he's a strange person.
In what respect?
The best thing I can say about, yeah, I met him myself, yeah. The best thing I can say about him is he was a damn good skier. Cross country skier, but I would say, I prefer to say nothing much else because I wasn't living with him, but I, yeah, he created different experiences in different people. And some people might say it was a good lead. I don't know. I'm still not speaking that one.
Yeah. And they had women with them, of course, as well, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, well, he didn't, but he... Well, yeah, his wife... let's see, he had... yeah, his wife was there. Jackie, what was the name there? Anyway, Jackie, was it?
Yeah.
Yeah, she was there. I met her, of course. And... Jenny,
Darlington.
Darlington, yeah. She was there. And apparently they tend to have the camp break up into two halves almost. One who supported Darlington, one who supported... You know, it was to us, you know, we hadn't been used to this woman in the Antarctic in anywhere in Britain in those days. And I'm not saying she shouldn't have some damn good women down there, but we were all used to the old, you know, man-style expedition, and we thought it was a bit of a screw up. But I remember there was a story Ronnie. I was told that when Ken Butler, who was leader of the British base that year, offered Jackie Ronnie, she wanted a ride. She never been out of the house door even. She wanted a ride on his sledge out to the Dion Islands, about 5 miles away. That she's grateful, and Ken took her on his dock team. They told me that Finn Ronnie stood at the door with the bloody biggest pair of binoculars he had, and pulled that sledge all the way from the base up, out to Dion Islands, back again. Yeah, there was no problem at all. And Finn, she was okay, and Ken Butler was no bloody fool even, but. So it was a bunch just after war days, all wanting to get something out of their system. You know, it was a good takeover from whatever you'd done before, and it was. So when I got back here eventually, and not long afterwards joined the Mountain Rescue Group in Calgary, they were a good bunch too. It was like a nice smoothing into society for me again.
What had been your instructions then, Ken? What was your mission going south? What were you supposed to be doing?
I'm not really sure. I was meteorologist, Met Observer. That's all anyone mentioned. I took it on myself to do some sledge journeys and to and then because you know you divide the jobs up between people what you're doing and George Barry was our base leader. He said, "You can be in charge of food and rations, Ken." I thought, "Well, I've been to the co-op for my mother in old days shopping." So anyway, I was in charge of rations, and I went through all this lot of stuff that had come, and all the stuff that England had forgotten, of course. one of the things that they'd forgotten was the zinc oxide for filling teeth. I got put down as ship's dentist for the dentist at the base there for some reason, I don't know why. And I remember we thought to think of every alternative we could for this damn zinc oxide, you know. And we eventually finished up with breaking up a gramophone record, giving up to get the wax, you know.
Did that work? Did that work?
It did. Well, I shouldn't tell you that. And we got this thing boarded up, and there was this hot black wax in a pan. And I remember we had two people hold the guy pretty steady that we'd then drop this bloody hot wax into his tooth. It seemed to work, but it wasn't very pleasant, you know what I mean? So it's one of those things you had to get used to, different things. And we were, you know, nowadays it's a completely different Antarctic now. It's everything that I call plasticized Antarctic. That's why I would never want to go back down there. If I could afford to fly inland to the centre somewhere and see some different things, but I would never. You take people on these so-called Antarctic cruises, and they see down all river. They see little bits of the coast. Yeah, sure, that's fair enough. The same. You can go under a rocket. I see more mountains, It's not the life. You can't go back to the men you knew, to the dogs you knew, to the life you knew. It's a completely different lifestyle.
The other thing that you were desperately short of was yeast, apparently.
Oh, yeah, we were. Because I remember Bill Bailey suggesting we search everywhere we could find some yeast. We even searched the fingernail link of the previous cook to see if there's any yeast droppings left in there. I wish all that, but we got by.
You, I think we're not originally intending to be based at Alexandra Island.
That's not quite to say. I was originally the second year I was supposed to go there.
So the first year you were definitely heading for Port Lockroy.
Well, as far as I knew, I wasn't. They might have been sending me somewhere else. But I don't know, but that's where it was. It was the first year we knew about. Yeah.
Tell me about Port Lockroy in your first year. What was it like?
Oh, very different what it is now. I mean, it looks come like a completely different place as far as I'm concerned. I didn't even recognise half of it. But they'd taken part of the old building away to rebuild the base effort down at Argentine Islands. A hut which had been left there suddenly disappeared, and they were going to blame the Argentine side of blaming them for everything. It wasn't their fault. It was actually, as it turned out later on, this hut had been washed away by a tsunami which had started off in Alaska.
Yeah.
Going all down and taking this sort of way. So anyway, they'd taken part of the old hut away from LaCroix to build something down at Base F.
That was when you left, wasn't it? They did that.
When what?
When you left, that's when they moved the hut, part of the hut away.
I'm sorry?
When you left, that's when they moved
that. Oh, okay. When we got down there, the hut had already had half of it taken away.
Okay.
So when we got down there, it was a hut, but it was only the big room that Finn Ronnie, not Finn Ronnie, had the British, Scout had gone, and it was a smaller base, and when they rebuilt it recently, they've rebuilt it to the original style with more, you know, more on it.
Were you comfortable there?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Lived in enough tents and make the place, yeah, we were comfortable. but it probably wouldn't be considered so. Everything is made for you now, don't play it. When I got to Calgary, after we met from the Andali, sometime after, and because the people, what do you call those people who make them steel buildings here, Mark?
Steel workers.
And yeah, the people who run the racetrack. Because this outfit that made steel buildings to the north and everything else, suddenly realized I'd been in Antarctica and I'd used lots of buildings. They took me on a tour of the factory here, showing me the building of these huts. And it was very interesting. They showed me this hut and all kind of fancy stuff in it, and this one and another one. And I said, okay, well, now, why don't you show me the stuff that's going to Antarctica or something? He said, these are the ones that are going to Antarctica. I said, these are some fancy oil rig up in the north or something. And they said, no, these are the things that are going to Antarctica. And I said, four walls with pictures on the walls and God knows what, and a rack and toothpaste on the screws. And you put four walls up and four or five bolts, and you got a hut of it. No, damn, God, this is so different from what I remember. Yeah.
You had a very cosy wooden hut with just, is it five bunks or six bunks?
We were there for a year, first year, and then I go back for another year.
And how many bunks in the hut?
We put in what you needed. We had four in ours, because there were four of us, but there had been more when Maher and Crowd were down. So that part had gone, but there's generally anywhere from 4 to 12, I suppose, depending on what the base is.
Yeah. Part of the job was to install the ionospheric equipment, which Roy Bailey was in charge of.
Oh, ionospheric, yeah.
What do you remember about putting up the mast and fixing up the gear?
Yeah, we had a. It took all of us to pull the wires and put this thing up, and I'll keep it straight. I remember we put this mast on a little hill behind base and made it safe with stones and digging whatever and massive wires to hold the damn thing up. It would have been a job for a seagull to have flown over the hut for a time, or so many wires going up. But it went up, and Bill was doing a good job. He was interested at that time in what they call the sporadic E layer.
Yeah.
Every now and then, on the screens across the world, you get this extra layer come in, and it was sporadic, and it was given the letter E because of where it fell, sporadic E, and they thought, one of the theories was that it might be due to meteorites striking the upper atmosphere. So as I was in the Astronomical Society, I slept outside a few nights looking for meteors, and if I saw a meteor, because I knew most of the stars in the sky in those days, don't know how you think. I could say, time, and they take a time out, say, south of such and such, is falling such and such, you describe its path across the night sky. And they hope that they saw something on the screen or not. But I don't think we've got any main correlations as far as I remember, but it was always hard to tell, unless you're doing a really long search. I remember getting involved in some of that work. I think it was when I got back from the Antarctic for Professor Blackett and Niels Bohr out at Jodrell Bank Research Station, doing the same thing, lying there and watching the night sky and calling out the meteor. So they were still looking for sporadic E then, but I don't think they got any correlation, but what I do remember is that Professor Blackett, this is a charitable bank near Manchester, saying Okay, well, let me know if anything unusual happens on the screen, and I'm going to bed now. And he disappeared into his tent or cabin or whatever. And so did Niels. I think it was born. I think it was one of those things. And about 2 or 3 in the morning, I remember there was something unusual on the screen. We awakened Blackett. And I remember Blackett came out in his blue and white underpants, big Wellington boots. It was a muddy day. Big Wellington boots and an umbrella. And Moore came out much the same dress. And I thought, well, guys, these are two of the top scientists in Britain at the time, walking across this field in muddy Wellington boots.
Your main job was to set up the new Met station at Port Lockroy.
Oh yeah, that's just putting a Met screen in place and taking a few. Yeah.
Did that go smoothly?
I'm sorry.
Did that go smoothly? Was it
easy? Oh yeah. You're only putting up a Stevenson screen and taking out a few thermometers and swinging, depending what equipment you got. Sure, I went all right. I got out as many times as I could. Doing sledging work and in fact, again, you've asked about equipment. Johnny Blythe and Bill Richards were very good at making things. I've made our own sledge from a pair of old broken down skis and bits of wood, and we did a few thousand miles with that thing, all together in bits and pieces.
Did you have all the Met equipment you needed?
All the Met equipment.
Yeah, everything you needed.
Basically, we had, because I had a kind of cylinder there for hydrogen. I think at first I made my own hydrogen out of whatever it was they gave me in those days. But for high altitude work, we got a balloon up to, was it 38,000 or 48,000? We got one of the records for a time. But you watch it through a field, Oh, yeah.
You're the first person I've come across in all these interviews who's mentioned using candles on the balloons.
Oh yeah, you put a night balloons that hang below. I've seen around with that, but most of the day observations. But we did send one night sometimes with a thing attached to it.
So you hung a night light underneath the balloon.
Yeah, I seem to think we hung it in a little cradle or something underneath.
Did you have any trouble with animals and birds in your equipment?
Animals and birds in the with the equipment. You mean, did they rip our equipment apart, or did we open a box and find a pigs that shipped to grizzly bear or something? Yeah, I don't remember any. Any real trouble there? Oh, yeah, just there's some damn thing which was up here in Canada that you see all the wires. Yeah, no, that was up here in Canada, I think. Yeah. Yeah. Down there, I don't remember. Although you've got to watch out for leopard seal. That's the most dangerous creature we had.
You had a close encounter, didn't you?
I beg your pardon?
You had a close encounter with an elephant seal.
You could call it that. We were in a boat and a dinghy, and I was John and Bill were the two experts in boats, the Falk and Arnold, great guys, wonderful fellows. So I didn't have anything to do with climbing. I was the one that did that. But they all joined, the only four of us, but it was deciding on a climbing route or something. That was my choice. But it was handling a boat and safely. It was their choice. I wouldn't have done it myself. I was in this dinghy and waiting to be pushed off. And John and Bill were just at the front end there, the sharp end, the pointed end, and I was at the back. And they, I suddenly saw, Bill say, and Bill, an expert shot, he was shot at the shooting range in England. He shot there anyway. And he said, somebody heard him say, give me the gun, John. And John throw the rifle quickly. I was sitting here, this all happening about 6 or 8 feet away. And Bill picks up the gun, it was pointing completely at my head here. And he said, "Hold it again." And bang, a soft-nosed bullet whizzed past my shoulder, and suddenly heard a flopping, squashy sound, and the front 4 feet of a 10 or 12, 13-foot leopard seal had dropped over the back of the boat and half across my knees here, you know. With blood and guts all pouring out of his mouth. So I've still got the stain somewhere on my old windproof sling of that. Oh, yeah, that was a leopard seal. They're dangerous devils.
Yeah. Did you have any other close calls or difficult moments, scary moments?
Oh, we were on bit twice, once or twice, when killer whales broke into it, you know, hit the thing. And we were going up the which channel? One of the channels, anyway, in a Norwegian scow, a rowing thing. And we got half. It was not long after we got to Antarctica. And we got half frozen in, and we were going to lift the oars up and break a hole to get the oar in to pull. And then Bill was sitting on the front of the boat, kicking holes in the ice. And there were about half a dozen or so, 50 or 60 foot whales going around us and underneath the boat and up again the other side. A little bit scary, but we trusted them to be friendly.
There are one or two other incidents I'd like to ask you about. You were trapped on Duma Island for several days, I believe.
Yeah,
what happened there, Ken?
Well, that's about 8 hours away, several miles away from here. We crossed this bay, this final bay, and I thought I would have liked to stop at the other side of it, but anyway, we didn't. We went on across the camp at the other side, and the sea froze during the night, more or less, or blew in anyway. Loose ice flows and such blew in, and we couldn't get away. That was just it. Was it.
How did we survive?
We killed a seal. We had about a few days' ration. We had about 3 or 4 days' rations, actually. And we were green. We'd only just got down the Antarctic a few years, I suppose. But we had at least got some more basics. And we killed a seal. And we got some of the meat, and we went out to get the rest. The leopard seal had come and take the rest. So we had a seal, and we had used this blubber for a blubber stove. You hang some blubber up above a small fire, and that drops in and feeds the fire, and makes it bigger and feeds more. You know, it's an ongoing process. So we cooked on a blubber stove. And everything, of course, gets black with soot, so it wasn't too bad. You could see the meat wasn't probably cooked, was it? It's all covered in soot anyway. So we managed that. One night, I remember thinking, my God, the wind's coming from the different direction on the tent. So I got up and went out, and I guess it was coming down off the plateau and blowing the ice out rather than. So we got up and had a quick breakfast and threw all the rest of the blubber and stuff in the boat and set off the base. Nothing particularly special.
You also had a couple of tricky moments whilst climbing as well, I believe, and
climbing.
Skiing. Climbing and skiing. Did you have any difficult times then?
I can think of, yeah. We made the... what might have been the first ascent of Jabot Peak by this particular route. Might have been by any route, but it was, we had to cross at one point. You go over a very narrow, steep couloir, several hundred feet, ice couloir, and ice, crumbly ice and snow. And you get to the top, you cross, circle around, cross around, and get up to the top. But you got a sheet of nasty, icy stuff to cross it just to the top. And we were coming back down, I think it was, anyway, on this icy stuff, and the ice axe you get if the temperature's just wrong, and I put an ice axe in, it'll sort of freeze and ice, and you know, hell of a job pulling it out sometimes. And this is what I understand this moment. I got my ice axe in, and I pulled it out to go down, it froze because I went in towards the axe, and I couldn't hold it. And so I went sailing down, and I sort of could see John down below 50 feet racing in all the slack, and I thought, I hope to God he stops me before I get to this crevasse. Oh, let's jump over it, one or two, but don't stop me. Anyway, I went sailing over the crevasse and upside down, inside out, and everything else, and the sky seems to, you know, you're going around in circles, you know, yeah. And I remember thinking when I hit the ground, I remember thinking, don't dig in fast, don't stick your claws in. I don't know, I crawled on my feet enough. You don't dig in fast, you know, dig in slowly, slowly, otherwise you'll tipple. So the old climbing instinct comes back to you when you need it. And well, we got down, came to a slithering stop, and there's, we went back up to get, because we got all the ice, so we had to get the stuff. 600 feet above us. So we climbed back up. I remember using my big hunting knife to chop steps and go. It wasn't bad.
And there was also an incident where you had a near miss with an avalanche.
As well, I saw the horse of avalanche. Oh, yeah, we saw an avalanche came just across our camp, just in the Thunder Glacier, which is bad for avalanches. And we'd stopped, camped there, and we moved on a few hundred yards because it wasn't too healthy looking above. But apparently, we hadn't moved on far enough because later in the afternoon, an avalanche came down and over that area where our old camp had been, but not where we were. So, unfortunately.
So you saw it come down where you'd been.
Well, we saw it, yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it impresses you, know.
Tell me about your the dogs you had in the Antarctic.
My what?
The dogs you had.
Oh, the dogs. Oh, yeah, Mark.
Yeah.
Can you pick me the yaps harness from downstairs on the wall? If I hold the dog harness in front here, we'll see, won't you?
I'll have to turn on the video.
Hanging on the wall downstairs, Mark, you know. If I hold my dog harness here in front of you, you'll be able to see it.
Okay.
Okay, well, Mark's going to get it. Bring it up, son, will you? Yeah, they're...
I can't see you at present because the cameras are switched off, but...
Oh, well, okay. But anyway, no, they're excellent creatures, husky dogs. We used Inuit dogs. The big heavy dogs of the Canadian North, they're a special breed. They just enjoy pulling, and they're bloody good at it. Thanks, yeah, Andy.
I don't know if you'll see it.
Van,
over that.
That's Yap's harness. It's done. That harness has done probably 2,000 miles of sledging. And it was also, before I got that dog team, Frank Elliott, it was his team, and this, I think he might have made this harness. I made several of them, I think he's made. And it's historical. I look after that like a treasure. But we, well, you probably, in that book of mine, I had my poem about this thing, tucked away in drawers and cases, are bits of souvenirs picked up in many places in many different years. Most of them in money, for money wouldn't sell, but the dear soul is precious for the memories it can bring. Mm. And there it is. It's, that's what I say. Whenever that whole harness binds me, the heart that's beginning to fail, it reminds me, slog on to the end of the trail.
This is a harness that you embroidered yourself with your own sewing kit, is that right?
This particular one, I think Frank started this thing. I think he made this one. I finished it off. But I made awesome. Yeah, you measure it to fit the dog, so it takes the strain in the right places, and they become quite precious. Mm-hmm.
Tell me about there were a couple of dogs that were very close to you. One was Old Captain.
Old Captain, he was a happy old son of a bitch. Yeah, he was. I think he was born in Labrador, maybe in East Greenland, but anyway, he came from the north, and he was a lead dog and a king dog. A king dog is a term that's used in the north more than down south. He's in charge of the team, you know, he growls and there's quiet. Not necessarily a leader, but Old Captain was a leader, as well as a king dog. And he was a wise old bird. When he got too old to catch penguins himself or whatever they're doing, but then he already taught the young puppies that followed him, you know, and then when they caught a penguin or whatever it was, he'd go and take it off them. But he was a good old dog, and you get used. You know, I was just thinking the other night, as a matter of fact, I think everybody should sometimes get a chance just to kneel in front of a husky dog and take his paw, if you like to do it, and look into his eyes. In the eyes, you'll often see a wonderful camera reflection of what he's looking at, maybe the trail you've just been on, or maybe the trail you're just about to go on. But it's something mystical about it, spiritual almost. And, husky dog's eyes, yeah.
Old Captain seems to have survived several attempts to shoot him.
I did. That's right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. See, you can't afford, unfortunately, you can't afford to keep dogs that are not working. They're not earning a feed, more or less. It's just not practical, unfortunately. It may be different nowadays, I don't know. But you couldn't, and you had to, if a dog had finished his legend life, maybe 2-3 years. 4 years, something, it depends. Then you would shoot them. No one liked doing it. You'd take I've seen people take dogs out, you know, they're, oh, give me that, you know, you're turning soft, so, you know, you take the same dog out and gone. And with Captain, that's where they come back. Oh, I can't do it.
So several people were meant to shoot him, but they couldn't bring themselves to do it.
That's right.
What happened in the end? Was it your job in the end,
Ken? Oh, yeah, when we kept him to the end as a house dog, more or less. I kept him, sure. I don't know what happened to them.
And the other dog you write about poetically is Yap.
Yap. He was my leader. This guy's dog. Oh.
That was at Admiralty Bay, yeah?
Yeah, but Frank Elliott had taken him all down the coast of the Weddell Sea before that. Yeah, Frank had trained him. Frank was a good driver. Frank Elliott died recently, you know. Frank Elliott died recently.
Did he? He was alive quite... last time I heard, he was still with us.
He died about a week ago.
Oh, really? Okay, I didn't know. Okay.
Maybe 2 weeks ago, but
Is there a story about Yap being very intelligent and avoiding a disaster?
Oh, yeah. Any good lead dog is, to a certain extent. I mean, they're not magical. They're damn good at reading bad eyes and bad water. And suddenly, if he'd refused to go across a piece of ice, I would never be stupid enough to force him over it, because he had probably had more sense than I had about whether the ice was safe or not. No, I would respect my lead dog to a large extent.
Mm. When it came for you to leave the Antarctic, what were your feelings, Ken?
When it came, sorry?
To have to leave at the
have
end.
Have to leave?
Yeah.
I would have liked, in fact, I applied to stay longer, and they wouldn't let you do it then. I'd already applied to go on the Transantarctic expedition whenever it came up, and that was all such a vague mix of what was happening and when. and who was running it. I lost track of what was happening. But I know I remember applying to when, first of all, Ken Butler seemed to be organizing a possible transantarctic expedition. And I think Foots came along a bit later into this lot. But I got my name down with Ken Butler's crowd, and then things seemed to change around. You know, the usual things in colonial office, you never know who's pushing who out and who's pushing who in. You know what I mean? It's so it didn't come off. It was suddenly a whole. I was away in colonial service by that time with Gene. I was surveying. I think I was surveying in the Pacific Islands or Borneo somewhere. And in the meantime, I suddenly realised when I was talking to Fuchs one day that the whole thing had changed over, and I wasn't sure who was running who. But they more or less got it fixed by then. So no, in any case, anyway, I got married and got kids coming along, and we had a good time in the Pacific and in Borneo. We were living among headhunters, etc., and they were just as peaceful in the middle of us. I didn't bother raising any more of it. But I would have liked to have gone on that trip, but I wasn't interested. I could have gone back. I was asked to go back in 52, a year after I got back, and rerun the survey down in the Weddell Sea after they had the fire and lost all the records there, you know. But I wasn't interested in going back to that area. I thought the Antarctic was, the Transantarctic was coming up and quicker than it was, and it didn't. And so I just went along with going to a service job in Borneo, and it was good. We enjoyed ourselves there, you know. And in the Pacific Islands, we lived in some pretty wild, lonely places, probably wilder and more lonely than Antarctica in many ways. So that's where I made our life. I think came to Canada and settled here.
And in your life, Ken, how do the Antarctic years rate? Are they the top of the pole?
Where was I? What?
How does the Antarctic years range in your whole life?
How does it range?
Yeah.
In my whole life, as to what I enjoyed, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, at one time it did, and to a certain extent might do now, but I wouldn't. It's different from what it used to be. It's not the Antarctic region. You know, it's a bloody artificial now. But,
no, it means over your whole life experience.
Or my whole life. Oh, hard to say. Gene and I had such wonderful times in Borneo, and living with headhunters, and you know, your life depended on their word. You know, if they took but it was a good experience. If they took their weapons, whatever it was, spears or blowpipes, and they were told by their chief to go and support Tuan here, look after him, and they said yes, they would do in front of his chief, and held their spears or spear throws or whatever to their chest in front of you, they, you know, knowing they'd be with you to the gates of hell. And some of them were, and so it was a good life. I can't argue. We had a good life.